we love to avoid thinking about death as much as possible, even though literally every single human being who's ever existed in history has died, and every single person alive on this planet now is headed that way too. Well, so I thought. There's data released today that says one in four doctors believe it is somewhat possible to preserve people's brains or bodies to be revived at a later date. It's from a survey of 300 physicians in the US. The doctors acknowledged that the idea of reanimating people was not without challenges, to say the least. They said it was plausible. In the words of Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should. You're about to hear from our resident philosopher about this, but would you look into having your body being preserved? How does the idea of returning later in life make you feel? Patrick Stokes is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for a chat I call Ask Aristotle. Pat, should we preserve your brain?
Mine specifically, probably no. I mean, it does take a certain amount of almost like self-importance to think that, you know, your brain is important enough that it should be allocated all these resources to keep it going in the very, very faint hope that one day it could be reanimated. But
your brain is very good.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Yeah. But even so, you know, it's a really open question about, given how remote the chances of this working are. And I take the point that, okay, one in four doctors think it's likely or whatever, but I don't know if that tells us a huge amount. Given how remote it is, on the one hand, it's a lot of resources to put into a very faint hope. But on the other hand, I kind of get it. If the choice is between absolute 100% certainty of death versus this incredibly remote chance that you might survive and you might be revived one day, yeah, okay, I can understand why people would take the bet. I'm just not sure I would myself.
People are already trying to prepare for this. Like, there are facilities where you can put yourself on ice.
Yeah, in fact, a mate of mine's been to one. I say mate of mine, actually one of my collaborators on the Digital Death and Immortality project I'm doing, Adam Buben, who's at the University of Leiden. He was back home in Arizona visiting family, and somebody knew someone at Alcor, which is like the biggest cryonics facility in America, where there's hundreds of people frozen in these giant, they call them duars, these big tubes that they're in. And somebody said, oh, this guy who's an expert on the philosophy of death is in town. Can he visit? And so he ended up getting a tour of the Alcor facility, and they gave him a little model of one of the duars to take home. Fun thing too, science fiction makes us assume that people are sort of, floating upright in those tanks. They're actually head down, which is a really curious thing.
Why is that kind of icky for me somehow?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, right? You sort of put your consciousness into it and you think, oh, it'd be really uncomfortable to be in that position. But of course, these are lifeless bodies. They're not experiencing anything. So in a way, it doesn't make any sense. But it's counterintuitive because it's not how we see bodies normally.
So this guy's, this is a collaborator of yours. You clearly talked about it with him. Did it change his perspective on the ethics of death and potential reanimation?
Not really. I mean, there's a whole, cryonics in particular has a whole range of really fascinating questions in it. And part of the reason Adam was invited to this is because one of the things he works on is the question of immortality and whether immortality would actually be preferable to a mortal life, or whether it would actually be so different that it might not be something we could rationally prefer, or it might even just be worse than living a mortal life. So there's a whole open debate around that. And I think that, the prospect of cryonics, it doesn't necessarily get you immortality. It just sort of gets you through one death and saves you from another one. But it's mostly interesting, I think, just insofar as it raises a whole bunch of fascinating conceptual questions about the boundary between life and death and whether those things are actually as clear and as binary as we normally assume they are.
Yeah, the whole thing of being amortal, is that there's an end point, that life is finite, and that kind of affects how we then live. If that was taken away, we could maybe think about living differently. Maybe you think you could make up for your sins in your later life and be as bad as you want now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different approaches to this. One is to say that, you know, we would miss out on what mortality teaches us, which is finitude and the importance of living each day and so on. And we might become, if we had infinite time, we might just become so kind of lazy and unmotivated, because there's always time to do things, that we just sort of, you know, don't live a recognizably human life. On the other hand, it could be that, and some philosophers have argued this too, that we would just learn how to have longer projects, and we would learn how to extend ourselves further across time, and it might not be so bad. It certainly doesn't sound terrible to me, but at the same time, I don't know that I would necessarily want to take a risk on cryonic suspension as a way of potentially getting there, because it's really doing is deferring a death. You can still presumably die once you've been reanimated as a cryonics patient.
Okay, from an ethics point of view, are you alive or are you dead when you're in this suspended state?
Well, this is the interesting thing. One of the things we take to be foundational about death, or one of the things that we take to be, you know, essential to the concept of death, is that death is irreversible. Mm. There was actually a case in the US a couple of years ago where a guy who was serving a life sentence in prison had a medical emergency. His heart stopped. They revived him, took him back to prison. And then he said, well, hang on, I was sentenced to life in prison and I died. Therefore, I should be released. And the court didn't buy this. They said, no, you're not dead, so you're going back to prison. He is dead now. And, you know, that was an interesting case in a way, because it shows that we think irreversibility is central to our concept of death. When we say someone died three times on the operating table, we don't actually mean they died. We mean that simply that their heart stopped or whatever. And this is where it becomes an interesting question with cryonics. Are the people in these duars actually dead? Well, on one hand, you can't do this to someone's body unless they're legally dead. So they are legally dead. But whether they are alive or dead, it seems, depends upon what happens in the distant future. Whether they are brought back or not determines whether they are alive or dead now. So firstly, we can't know if they're alive or dead. And secondly, it just seems like something's gone badly wrong when we conclude that whether a body is in a particular state right now depends upon something that's going to happen in the far future.
What this suggests is
that our concept of life and death just might not map very well onto underlying biological realities, which may be a lot messier than we normally assume.
It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Patrick Stokes. He joins me fortnightly. He's our resident ethicist. I call our chats Ask Aristotle, even though he's not an Aristotelian ethicist. We're talking about whether, if you knew that there was a slim, slim, slim chance that you could be reanimated at some stage, would you want your body preserved? Does it mean you're returning as who you are? What does it mean for death? We're delving into all of these things right now on Life Matters. Lots of philosophers on the text line, Pat. One person's asking about religions that promise an afterlife, and another's asking, what of the soul? What does ethics and philosophy tell us about these concepts?
Well, there's a huge amount there. One is this question that we raised a second ago about whether immortality would be desirable or not. That applies, interestingly, to questions of an afterlife. You know, what can you imagine doing forever that would actually be worthwhile doing and would be satisfying to do? And so one of the assumptions here is that if there is an afterlife, it has to be somehow so radically different from human life, and so discontinuous from human life, that we can't even necessarily get a good grip on what it would be like in order for it to be satisfying and to be something we could desire. The soul's an interesting one too, right? The soul has a nice usefulness in terms of solving a bunch of philosophical problems, right? But interestingly, as John Locke noted in the 17th century, it doesn't actually work as well as we might think as an idea for explaining how you can be alive in one place and then dead in another place, let's say. Because as Locke said, it really comes down to your psychological states, right? And so the assumption is that if your soul is just your mind, what if we could wipe your soul and put someone else's thoughts in it? Would that be you who is reborn in that soul, or who lives in the afterlife in that soul? It's not at all clear that we would be.
Pat, I'm getting so many questions. I feel like I want to do like a rapid fire philosophy round with you. One says, how does cryonics affect life insurance? Can your heirs collect if you're being preserved for future life?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, as things stand now, you're legally dead, and so all the stuff that would happen normally when someone dies occurs. So, yeah, if you come back, it could be really, really awkward. You know, the idea that you're going to be able to get your estate back when it's been distributed, you know, 5, 6, 7 generations ago. Yeah, good luck.
Okay, so this one refers to, someone says, my first thought is how expensive this would be and how this is a perfect example of health equity. I bet they don't have concession prices. What of the equity argument?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, again, something that's often talked about when we talk about immortality, because, of course, there's a whole bunch of tech bros who are also trying to extend human life indefinitely in various ways. And one of the things that comes up is that's going to create an inequity that only the really rich people in the global north are going to be able to afford that kind of life extension. And so it really does just sort of potentially reinforce a bunch of economic injustices. And yeah, also it does take up a lot of resources. Apparently cryonics doesn't take up as much electricity as you might think, but it's still a case where there's a lot of space and a lot of electricity and a lot of, you know, labor and other resources that are all built into trying to keep these people in a state where possibly maybe one day they might possibly be brought back. So it's a big speculative spend on something that may never pay off.
And another final question in rapid fire round. So the thought is we can also save our memories, because that's basically what defines us as a person. Mm. What have we learned and what we remember?
Yeah, and this is an interesting point about what's called psychological continuity, which I sort of touched on with Locke, right? That it's not just enough that we come back to life. It's also that we want to have an ongoing psychological life. We want there to be a person in the future who will remember us and who we now can anticipate having their experiences. Can cryonics do that? Well, we actually just possibly don't know enough about the brain to be absolutely sure that it could do that. There's a huge number of unknowns about how the brain encodes information and, you know, what would happen if you totally shut a brain down, shut down all the electricity. Could you restart it and have all of those neural connections working again? There's just a huge amount of unknown technical stuff way above my pay grade as a philosopher that comes into play there.
Okay, so we've got a quarter of 300 American doctors saying plausible, maybe. How seriously are we actually taking this?
Well, some people are taking it seriously enough to actually go ahead and do it. You know, the first Australian cryonics patient has already been preserved. So that's it is happening. But it is a fairly niche thing because of the sort of expenses involved. And I think also the mindset that is involved. I think for the vast majority of us, certainly for the time being, death is something that unfortunately we have to kind of reconcile ourselves to. But again, maybe that teaches us things that are really important too. Things about preciousness, things about finitude. And the idea that, you know, as Kierkegaard, who was my guy, I did my PhD, said, it's not about living each day as if it's your last. It's about living each day as if it could be the last, but it could also be the first in a long life to come. It's that uncertainty that maybe teaches us something.
Pat, it's always so illuminating speaking with you. Thank you, as always, for joining me.
Thanks very much, Tegan.
Patrick Stokes, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Deakin University.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.